And ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the prosecution is not going to get that man today. No, because I'm going to get him.
Welcome to this edition of the Hagmann Report. Doug Hagmann flying solo tonight. Joe's out sick. Welcome to this broadcast. It is the Monday after the long Thanksgiving holiday. Hopefully everyone had a great Thanksgiving, of course, as is custom, Friday, work Friday, had a show up Friday, as well as work throughout the weekend in attempting to determine what's going on out there. Let me lead off with this. Since 1997, there have been 268 cases of sexual harassment in Congress, which have been settled with your tax dollars, my tax dollars, for $17,250,854. And they're all under seal. Unseal the deals. Let's do that. Hashtag unseal the deals. 20 years, 1997 through 2017, 268 cases of sexual harassment against the members of Congress, the perverse powers that are, $17,250,854. And my wife asked a good question. Who's paying this? Well, aside, obviously we are. Who's authorizing the payments and who's withholding the information? She, you can tell she lives with a detective, right? So it's the office, or the Congressional Office of Compliance, actually, as I have learned, which was an office. Now listen to this. The Congressional Office of Compliance was started back in 95 in order to add more transparency to Congress. How's that working out for us when they sealed the deals of 268 cases of sexual harassment? By the way, on Friday, Laura Loomer was on with Alex Jones. Was it Friday? I think it was. And she had noted that a young woman, 19 currently, was going to come out with additional allegations against a sitting member of Congress right now, male, female, I don't know. And at 4:30 in the morning, she received a telephone call saying, hey, you're under an NDA contract, non-disclosure agreement, so you can't do that. And at 4:30 a.m., there's no, you know, nothing to see here, folks. So you've got perversity within the powers. Perversity. But, you know, I just want to urge people to look beyond this. Look beyond the 264 cases. What's going on here with respect to this perversity? It's the normalization of the abhorrent behavior that we've seen since Bill Clinton has been in office. Didn't Bill Clinton by himself redefine what is normal? It's okay to get an intern in the Oval Office, which became the oral office for a while, right? Remember that? And of course, you know, it all depends on what is. So there's a lot of redefining of our moral and character integrity back in the 90s. What we're seeing today is just merely a consequence of that. The acceptance, the tolerance of that behavior. That's what we're seeing today. I got a letter today from a guy. He said he's not going to support us any longer. You know why? Because I in particular, am so rough on homosexuals. Okay? Don't. Please, don't. Homosexuality, in my view, is not inherent. It's not you're not born a homosexual. It's a learned behavior. And if you look at the DSM, the diagnostics manuals, that should tell you, and how those have been redefined. Another letter today, interestingly enough, saying two letters in one day, saying, you know what, I supported you in the past, and because you support Alex Jones, I'm not going to support you anymore. It was like Pile on Doug Day today. Don't. Because what we're seeing, look, there's too much going on today. I support Alex Jones. I support InfoWars. I support the mission that he is on. And, period. Can we afford to frag the very people who are on our side? No, we can't. We cannot afford to frag the truth tellers out there. Now, we don't have to agree with them in principle, or I'm sorry, we don't have to agree with them in terms of everything, 100% across the board. Do I agree with Alex Jones on 100% of things? No. Does he agree with me on 100%? No. No, absolutely not. But there's give and take there. So we have to, but we are in the fight of our lives today. The power elite in Washington, D.C., the what is known as the shadow government or the permanent state, the federal bureaucracy that encompasses some 2.6 million individuals plus NGOs plus related entities and federal bureaucrats known as the deep state. We're fighting that Leviathan, and we need all the help we can get. And look, there's we can't get the truth on Las Vegas. We can't get the truth on just about anything that's taking place. Where's the Department of Justice, Jeff Sessions, on Uranium One? Where's the Department of Justice on the Clinton emails? Where, and I did my show today on these issues. Sessions is AWOL, absent, MIA. So I'm bringing this back to people like Alex Jones, for example, people like Rick Wiles. Do I agree with Rick on everything? No, of course not. Does he agree with me? Of course not. But we agree in principle that we're fighting a beast that's going to take down this country. So can we afford this infighting? Of course not. Because that's the very tactic that our enemies are doing to us every single day. They're tearing us down. They're attempting to tear us down. They're going after our sponsors. Sean Hannity. I got an email saying, lay off the support of Sean Hannity. On my own personal Twitter account, which I must say, of course, that these are my own, at Hagman PI, as opposed to Hagman Report, these are my own. Lay off the support of Hannity. You're just advancing the deep state. Really? Sean Hannity is the only one, essentially, at Fox News that has a permanent anchor spot that is attempting to lay out the permanent state. And for that, look what he gets. So I'm not going to back off my support on him. And I don't care if people contact all of our sponsors and we take hits. Look, I took a hit before in revenue from sponsors for saying that we would not stand with the people who were supporting the Obergefell decision. I'm not going to compromise on my morals. I'm not going to compromise on our Judeo-Christian ethics. And I even have people who write to me and say, well, Judeo-Christian ethics, there is no such a thing. Judaism, Christianity, it's just a mis... really? That's what you're going to fight with? Really? You're going to pick apart that statement? That's what you want to... That's where you're going to put your flag? On that hill? That's where... Okay. So, anyway. You get the idea. 264 cases... or 268 cases of sexual harassment, $17.25 million. Your tax dollars, my tax dollars, we have no answers. And, of course, Joe Barton comes out with an abhorrent video. Representative Joe Barton, never Trumper, GOP. And, by the way, this is not a Republican-Democrat issue of this sexual perversion. This is a good versus evil issue. Joe Barton comes out with this abhorrent video sent to this young woman. It was not a still image. Alex Jones had played that or showed that and then took it down. He explains why. I saw it. I wasn't going to post it. What a sick puppy this guy is. Representative Joe Barton. I don't even care what his politics are. I really don't care. Get the hell out. And get him out. Can't get answers on Vegas. We got somebody maybe with us that will give us answers. Before we get to them, I want to mention, too, those who do choose to support us. Eric wanted me to make sure I let everyone know that the $25 reward for the private live stream, the Patreon, no, this is a notice and alert to all patrons on Patreon. We have a Patreon account. And the $25 reward for private live stream will take place this Sunday, December 3rd at 7 o'clock p.m. Eastern Time. Those of you who have partnered up with us at this level, you'll receive an email of how to access this. And we'll walk you through how to connect to the interactive live stream. For those that would like to join for the live stream, that's a reward. I guess at different levels you have rewards, and that's one of the rewards. And you could talk to me and you know, take me to the woodshed as well if you want. I can hold my own, but hey, it's up to you. You can, for those who would like to join the live stream that have not yet pledged the $25, you can do so by November 30th at 11:59 p.m. Eastern Time. Any patrons that pledge to this level after that will, of course, have to wait until the next month's live stream. And what you can expect is an interactive face-to-face group video conference. Again, this is not one-on-one. This is a group video conference. Group discussion, news, and current events, and you can ask Joe and I anything you want. Or boxers there, so you don't have to ask that question. There's a good chance the live stream will go longer than an hour. So, also the Hagman Forum is going to be ready to launch at the end of this week. It should be ready by the end of the week. The $25 and $10 patrons will receive an invite by email to set up an account there. It's going to be fun because I'm looking forward to kind of being involved in this forum, this private chat forum or this private message board forum. So that's coming up at the end of the week. With us now, Doug Papa, a guest that we had on last week, just an incredible, incredible guest. Did you hear from last week or from, was it last week or was it? It was probably a week and a half ago. I have to get the date. If you go to our video page, it's there, Doug Papa. His Twitter, of course, is Doug_Papa, and his website is DougPapa.blogspot.com. Doug, welcome to the program, sir.
Good evening, guys. How you doing, Joe and Doug? Nice to be again here.
Well, good. Joe's out sick tonight, so it's just you and me, my friend. Just you and me.
Okay.
So.
Okay.
I got to tell you, the last time that you were on, you talked about this is the very issue I opened up with, basically the perversion. Now, right. what do we do with this? My goodness, we're seeing this. Just it's crazy, isn't it?
Well, you know what happens when, like I said the other day, when one woman or one complainant comes out, feel like they're not alone. And that's going to eventually happen with the Stallone case. There's no doubt about it. I see Stallone still on the internet and his attorneys making comments, basically calling the victim a liar, saying it didn't happen. So in essence, he's not only calling the victim a liar, he's calling myself a liar. The police report, he's saying it's not genuine. He's calling the police officer, his name was mentioned, John, in the Daily Mail article, so saying this stuff is not true. He's got Brigitte Nielsen coming out now saying it didn't happen because she was with them, and this other guy who was 15 years old at the time, David Mendenhall. I'm going to tell all three of these individuals this, okay? Neither one of you is telling the truth, okay? That's all I could say. Sylvester Stallone knows exactly what he did 30 years ago to that 16-year-old girl. And come out and say, listen, it didn't happen, and have your ex-wife come out and say she was with you the whole time. I'm going to tell you right now, that is a flat-out, all-out lie. And she's got enough skeletons in her closet that'll eventually fall out of the closet. But he's a liar. You know, that's what these people do. You know, they come out and they start demeaning the victims. You know, they run after them, derogatory remarks. It didn't happen. It didn't happen. Well, you know what? When there's more than one person coming out and there's been other allegations over the years, even with Sylvester Stallone and these other guys, you know, what are you going to say? So it is what it is. And what bothers me a lot with these things is these are people in power. Either they're celebrities, they're politicians, they have the fame, they got the money, and, you know, they can pay people off to tell them to keep their mouth shut and hire high-priced attorneys who will do whatever they can to try to track down dirt and stuff to ruin the reputation of the victims coming out. And to those attorneys that do that and to those private investigators that do that, and there's a couple of ones that I'm not going to mention, you know who you are. You know, you're just as bad as the person that you are representing. So that's what I got to say on that subject there.
And you've been a police officer, a detective. You know, continuing course of criminal conduct, of course, is something we look at and something you look at. And, of course, it's right there. And it's these people don't stop. I don't believe a leopard changes its spots, and these people don't change their behavior.
No, it'll continue.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not going to stop.
Exactly. Now we're not. What we've done is we've. I've just. You've got the full hour. Okay, so let's talk. I know there's a number of issues or a couple of issues you want to talk about, some information that you want to break on this show, breaking information. So I'm going to let you lead with what you want to lead off with, and I'll follow along here, and let's have a discussion. Where do you want to start?
Okay, the first thing I want to say is we haven't had a press conference out here, I don't think, since October 13th with the FBI or Sheriff Joe Lombardo, who runs the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. However, last Tuesday, before Thanksgiving, Aaron Rouse, who's the special agent in charge of the Las Vegas field office, spoke to one of the local Nevada radio stations, and I believe it's here, it's KNPR-FM, and they were asking him about the motive why they believe Paddock did what he did. And that's the big question that people ask, is why he did what he did. Okay, and this is what, I'll read his exact comment here because I don't want to misquote him, and this is what he said. Everyone wants to know why, FBI Special Agent Aaron Rouse told the radio station. And then he said, I believe when this is finalized, we're going to come as close as possible to answering that question. And then it says here, when he was asked by the public, when could the public expect the final report on the shooting, Rouse declined to provide a timeline. And then he said, I doubt it's going to take a very, very long time based upon what I know today, he said, but I want to get it right. So at some point, he sounds like he's saying this, at some point in the future, in the near future, we're going to hear something on their report or to what Paddock's motives were. That his motives, to me, doesn't really concern me that much. I mean, he killed a bunch of people. You know, if he's connected to a terrorist organization, domestic or foreign, yes, I want to know that, but, you know, I'm more interested in the people who were killed and the police investigation. Now, the following Wednesday, which was last week, before Thanksgiving, Sheriff Lombardo gave a statement to the Las Vegas Review-Journal, and he said that based on their investigation thus far with the forensics, that over 1,100 rounds were fired by Stephen Paddock in the 10-minute period that he was firing out the windows from his 32nd floor suite at the Mandalay Bay. He also said that some of the weapons had jammed, I guess because they had tested some of the weapons, and he said here, quote, there was over 4,000 live rounds still in the room. He didn't elaborate on how many weapons jammed and what those weapons, the type of weapons that jammed, but you know, this has always been one of the biggest things with me on this case is they originally said there were 23 firearms in that room that he brought in, and now the sheriff confirmed 4,000 rounds of ammunition, live ammunition, were found in the room after he allegedly shot himself. So that's always been a concern with me because I don't understand to this day, and I'm sure that the police and the FBI may or may not know, is why he went through these elaborate procedures before he even fired out the window. Put cameras out in the hall. They said there were electronic devices inside the room, multiple laptops, cell phones, multiple cell phones. And just to note, there was allegedly, from what I hear, a cell phone charger that was in the room that didn't match any of the cell phones that were in the room. That's been out right in the media floating around out here. So my thing is, you go through this elaborate procedure, you know, you barricade the fire stairwell door. I believe one of the cops said there were screws in the door so you couldn't come up from the outside stairwell, which was adjacent right to his door's front suite, the front door to his suite, excuse me. And he went through this elaborate procedure. He fires allegedly for 10 minutes out the window, and then they believe that he shot himself. Okay?
All right.
Maybe it happened like that. But as an investigator, I have to ask myself, why? Why did he go through the elaborate procedure? What made him stop and just all of a sudden blow his brains out when he has all these other weapons in the room? Now, I'm sure when the sheriff said some of the weapons were jammed, that not all 23 weapons in that room were jammed. That we know he had 23 weapons, according to what the police told us, and he had all this live ammunition.
Right.
As a matter of fact, when one of the cops was on 60 Minutes that entered the room, I'm going to bring up a point on that later, he said there was actually, I think it was said, there was actually an assault rifle that was facing the door. So in other words, he can grab it real quick on the floor and shoot at cops coming in. So the big question to me is, why go through this elaborate procedure? Why after 10 minutes did he say, you know, if indeed that's the way it happened, that's the end, I'm going to blow my brains out, when even the cops said on 60 Minutes he could have held us off for hours in a firefight. So that's the big question to me. I'm not so much concerned as why he did it. He did it for one of two reasons. Either somebody, you know, was involved with him and told him to do it, but the end result is, whether you're acting alone, you're crazy. Nobody kills 58, 59 people and fires and wounds 500 people more. So the motive there, he's crazy, in my opinion. And that's not my, you know, it's not a psychiatric term. I'm not a psychiatrist, a psychologist. I'm just saying that he's obviously nuts. He killed all those people. So
sure,
that's what we got at this point. Now, what I want to bring up is, before I forget, I wrote 35 stories for the Baltimore Post-Examiner. Obviously, we can't talk in an hour everything that's in there, but I broke three different things when I was writing for the Baltimore Post-Examiner. I was writing those stories. The first thing I broke was that a SWAT officer fired his weapon into the room the night of the when Paddock was in the room, after they went into they breached the door.
Right.
I broke that story. I was the only one in the country that broke that, and everybody picked it up about 2 or 3 weeks later. Second story I broke was that the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department had to borrow three armored vehicles from a private security company out here called Battlefield Vegas. And I was the first one to break that story. And we still don't know to this day, because nobody will talk when you call them up over there, is why the police department had to borrow armored vehicles from a private company. When I wrote my story, I raised the question that do they not have enough equipment in this county to protect citizens on events like this, that they had to borrow three armored vehicles from this private company? Now, point being on that is, I went down to Battlefield Vegas, and they would not talk to me. They said, we can't tell you anything. You need to, you know, refer to the police department, let's go to the police department. They have no comment. They say active investigation. So they wouldn't tell me anything. I took some photographs down there of some of the armored vehicles I have. They have about 100 vehicles in Battlefield Vegas, and they have armored personnel carriers, Humvees, and tanks and all kinds of stuff. But they wouldn't tell me what actual vehicles that was requested by the police department that night. And how I found out about that was, and that's why I got so involved in this case, the night the massacre happened, I was on the phone with somebody, and the kid came in and says, there's a terrorist incident going on the Strip. So I immediately hung up the phone, turned on the scanner out here, and I was listening to everything live as it was happening. So between October 1st and today, I must have listened to those police recordings, because I recorded some of them I got from other sources, over dozens and dozens of times. So it was very, it was compelling when I was listening to it, because one of the things I want to bring out as a former police officer and cop is that, and I raised this issue in one of my stories, why was it that all the tactical communications that night were being broadcast live for the whole world to hear? There was no encryption. And people say, what's the big deal with that? I said, well, it's a big deal tactically from a police officer's standpoint, because all the tactical communications, not only on the ground of where strike teams were going at the different casinos for 2 hours because there were shot calls coming in for active shooters in multiple locations for 2 hours after Paddock stopped firing a weapon. We could talk about that later. But my point being here is that inside the Mandalay Bay, all the movements of the police and the teams that went in, and they did a fantastic job getting in that hotel fast, okay, was all broadcasted for everybody to hear. What stairwells they were going in, you know, be careful for booby traps. We're in 300 stairwell. We're outside his door later on, they were saying. Even when you hear which was broadcasted, you know, on television later on, the SWAT officer, when he was going to breach the door with explosives, he says, you know, we're going to breach the door. We got to pop the door. And particularly something really important, so I'll talk about it later, is when he says, we have to pop this door.
Yeah,
because we don't know if he's in the room or he went somewhere else.
Yeah.
I'll get into that later, because that's just unbelievable to me.
Thank you.
So anyway, all these tactical communications are being broadcast for everybody to hear. Now, people ask me, you know, why do you keep hopping on that, Doug? What is the big issue? Now, several years ago, Metro changed their communication system. They had a big $45 million debacle, I believe, when Sheriff Joe Lombardo was the assistant sheriff, undersheriff. He was involved in buying a new radio system. It didn't work. It was called Skyview or something like that. It was $45 million waste of money. So they went out, they got a new system, and in short, it's the P25 Phase 2 system that's out there. Now, I'm bringing that up because that basically made all analog police scatters that people and news people were listening to police communications obsolete, because you have to have a scanner that particularly picks up Phase 2 P25. So I'm bringing that up because when I was listening to it on the scanner that night, another law enforcement officer, a friend of mine, called me up, and he said, you know, we're listening to this, and he's listening. So I said, when did you go out and buy those scanners for expenses? There's only like two or three manufacturers on the market that make them, like $500. And he says, no, it's being broadcast on a couple of sites. One of them was Broadcastify on the Internet. So I'm bringing that up because you didn't need it. You did not need to be in Las Vegas with a scanner listening to the tactical communications of what was going on that night. I'm saying this for a point, sir. You could have been in Afghanistan and Iraq and Russia, sitting in a cave somewhere with satellite television, watching CNN as everything was going live, because CNN and all the news agencies were out here, they were showing it live. And then you have your computer set up, your laptop, and you're listening to Broadcastify with all these tactical communications going on, which floor the stairwells are in, when they're putting explosives on the door. And my point being is, because had this been an actual terrorist incident with multiple people involved, they would have had a sat phone at that location, and that guy would have been on the sat phone to his people out here saying, be careful, they're coming up, they're in the stairwell, they're right outside the door, they're going to put the explosives on. And had there been somebody else in that room with Paddock, if it was multiple people, they could have went out with a grenade and killed all those cops in the stairwell. My point being is, simple, is that those tactical communications should never have been broadcasted live for everybody to hear. Now, another thing they did there that night, okay, they advertised to the whole world that there's only four SWAT teams in Las Vegas, because one of the officers came on, these are the commanders that are doing this over the radio, and said when the FBI SWAT team gets here, the city of Henderson SWAT team, that's a separate city with the police department, and North Las Vegas, separate city, when their SWAT teams get here, have them go to the staging area. Somebody else comes to the radio, where's the staging area at? Russell Road on the Boulevard. So all this is going across the radio, and everybody knows now there's only four SWAT teams in Clark County that could ever respond in case you have an incident, okay? And then the other thing they said was when the dispatcher came across the radio and said, units be advised, there's going to be three armored vehicles en route to the staging area, and they're going to be a pickup truck follow them, obviously, because they're going to drop off the armored vehicles and somebody's going to pick up the drivers and leave, and that was broadcasted over. So now people thinking, okay, you know, there's only four SWAT teams in Clark County that can respond on, you know, a Mumbai-type attack, just using that as an example. And obviously, Metro doesn't have enough armored vehicles because they had to go out and they had to borrow armored vehicles from a private company. And I wrote a story about that, and that's very, very important to me, because I said it in the story, that if one of the richest tourists, if the Metro, Las Vegas Metro Police Department does not have enough armored vehicles to protect the citizens and tourists that come to this city, that when an emergency happens, like what happened that night, that they have to go out and borrow armored vehicles from a private company, something is wrong with the administration of the police department. Whether it's the current administration or the previous administration, something is wrong there. And another thing you hear on the radio, too, is where some of the officers were requesting more rifles. When they say that, what they're asking for is police officers with the AR-15 platform type rifles. Talking to police officers, they tell me that not all the police officers in Metro and the patrol have those assault weapons in their vehicle. You know, they have shotguns and stuff, because if they want them, if they're not on a specialized team, they have to go out and purchase them themselves. And the department had made it so hard with so many rules and regulations to get those weapons. I mean, if you take it out of your car to put in your trunk, you got to do a report. I took it out and I held it, something like that. So not everybody, not all the patrol officers in Clark County, Las Vegas Mountain Police Department, have, the assault weapons, I'll call it that, AR, 15 platform type weapons, or assault weapons in their vehicle. And that's a disgusting shame. And plus, they got to go out and buy them. If they're not like on a SWAT team or a special team, they got to go out and buy those weapons themselves. And those weapons cost anywhere from $2,000 and up. So, on a policeman's salary, that bothers me as an ex-cop and an ex-citizen. If you don't have the equipment Amen. To roll out right away on an emergency, then, what's going on with the leadership in the police department?
Very well said. Doug, I'm going to give you your voice a rest there just momentarily. I just want to reintroduce you to our guests to our listeners who are coming into the show. Top cop, at least, he's not going to tell you that, but he's Detective of the Year. A long history of public service as a police officer detective. Doug Papa is our guest follow him on Twitter, Doug Papa. I know I do. And we're so glad to have him. And, of course, he's got he writes for the Baltimore Sun. And just go to his Twitter page. There you can get to his website as well, Doug Papa website. And, of course, his writings for the paper as well. And he's talking with the topic right now is the inconsistencies in Las Vegas. And what he's known, he's brought up two good points, one being the live broadcast. And by the way, I was awakened at some point during that time, and I was able to tune right in to the live feed as he's saying. So if you're in Afghanistan or if you're in Iraq or some, it doesn't matter. You could hear everything going on. Is that right? Mm. And of course, yeah. Go ahead and continue, Doug. I just want to give you a little break.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Yeah, there's a couple of things I want to hit on. I want to get out because I know we only got like a half hour left. Okay. As a former criminal investigator, I'm going to make this statement. Okay. When you are investigating a crime and you have a crime scene, the most important thing is to secure and the integrity of that crime scene, whether that crime scene is going to last an hour or days, as in this case, okay? Now, when someone compromises a crime scene, that, depending on which state you're in, that could be interfering with the criminal investigation, it could be obstruction of justice, okay? Now, you're asking me, people, why you bring that up? And I'll tell you, because the next day, on October 3rd, and the shooting happened on October 1st, crime scene photographs were released to the press all over the country. They went all over the world. Crime scene photographs showing Paddock's dead body, the blood coming out of his head, what the room looked like, the weapons. You all see them. Those are the crime scene photographs, okay? Now, I'm going to say this as breaking news on the Hagman Report, okay? Two of the photographs of the weapons that first aired on television out of Fox 25 Boston, okay? There were two photographs of the rifles that was leaked by a police department source. Now, a couple of weeks ago, Sheriff Joe Lombardo was being interviewed out here by a local reporter, and I get to some of the stuff that he said that just didn't make any sense. But when they asked about that, he said, well, you know, they're probably never going to be able to find out because about 50 people were in the chain of those photographs, so we're never going to be able to find out. Now, that was just like 2-3 weeks ago. Now, when it originally happened right after the shooting, you can go back and look at the YouTube press conferences, he was pretty ticked off because they said, are those genuine photographs? And he said, yes, those are crime scene photographs, and I'm not too happy about it. So why am I bringing this up? Because I received information that two of the photographs that went to a reporter at Fox 25 in Boston came from a command personnel. Listen to what I just said. Not a line officer. Command personnel from the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. And it went to a reporter who this person, when she was a reporter out here years ago, was romantically involved with. Okay? Now, I was told by another reporter the other day that those crime scene photographs that were leaked to a reporter, they were worth about $10,000 a photograph. Now, I have no information that this person that released those at least two photographs to Boston 25 got paid for it, but he did, okay? And this was a command personnel within the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, and he compromised a major homicide investigation. Not just any homicide investigation, that's bad enough, but the worst mass shooting in United States history, he compromised that investigation. So did any other personnel, whether it was command or line level, that released the other crime scene photographs that hit the news within 2 days, 1 or 2 days after the event. Now, okay, that hallway up on the 32nd floor of Mandalay Bay was sealed as a crime scene because when he, you know, that the whole, not the room was a crime scene too, but the hallway was because he shot, you know, outside the door when he hit Campos, allegedly hit Campos in the leg and everything. So the whole hallway was blocked. And I originally thought it was guarded by Mandalay Bay Security, but I heard the other day from a source that it was not. It was Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department officers who were sealing that hall, basically guarding the hall for, you know, for days because it was an active crime scene. Okay. Somebody let a female reporter from Los Angeles into that crime scene area, and she put her camera into the door and took photographs of whatever she can reach with a hand going to the door. Those were publicized all over the internet. So you have personnel from the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department compromising the worst mass shooting in U.S. history thus far, the criminal homicide investigation of that. And it's a total disgrace that that actually happened. Okay?
Amen.
Now, I want to bring up another point over here. Okay? Because when I call up Metro and was asking them questions on all the stories I was writing, of course, there's an active investigation, I hang up the phone. They're not going to tell you anything. Okay? Joe Lombardo and Undersheriff Kevin McMahill told the press, and you go back and look at the press conferences, that the SWAT team went into the room, okay, when they breached the door. Now, that is a lie, okay? It didn't happen, okay? One SWAT officer went in that room. His name was Levi Hancock. He's the gentleman, I believe you hear on the radio, said he was going to breach the door. He's the one that on 60 Minutes, the four officers who were in there, the three of those officers went into the room with him, said he had the explosives on him, he went in. Now, for a week, they were telling us the SWAT team went in. Now, the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department has, from what I understand, a 40-member SWAT team that's split up into two teams, where they call it red, yellow, blue, green, whatever. But there's two teams, 40 members total on the entire team. Okay? They did not breach that room until an hour and 5 minutes after Paddock fired his last shot. Okay? And the officers that, like I said, when they responded to the Mandalay Bay, they got there fast. They were up in that stairwell within minutes after he stopped firing. But they were told to hold off until SWAT got there and made a plan. Well, SWAT never got there, okay? A SWAT team is a team. There's no I in team. There was no team in that hallwell of SWAT. There was one SWAT officer. That was Levi Hancock. So the following Sunday after the shooting, they put these four guys on 60 Minutes, okay? One of them, I think his name was Casey Clarkson. He was not one of the bosses that breached the room. He got hit in the neck. He stayed to help people in the concert venue. And all those cops that night, and I wrote a whole story on this, all those police officers from Metro that were in that concert venue, okay, to me, were absolute heroes, okay? When you listen to the radio traffic, and I did a whole story on this, you can go back and read the stories on the Baltimore Post-Examiner, they were putting people in patrol cars, they were putting tourniquets on people, they were just absolutely amazing. And if they were all here today, I'd shake every single one of them hands. But to get back to this other thing, where was the 40-member Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department SWAT team the night of the worst mass shooting in modern American history? They were not in the stairwell. Because an hour and 5 minutes later, the people who went into that room were Levi Hancock, who breached the door with explosives, and then the two canine officers, I think the name was Bitsko and Newton, that were on 60 Minutes, and then Officer Donaldson, who was a gang detective. They were all on 60 Minutes. Now, I thought that Monday morning that there would be satellite trucks parked outside of Metro headquarters down here on Martin Luther King Boulevard. Nothing. Because I would want to know this from Sheriff Lombardo. Why, after an hour and 5 minutes, one of your SWAT guys, all those guys that went in that room that night were heroes, because you don't know what you're facing when you go in there. You don't know if the Paddock, they had no idea Paddock was Paddock. They didn't know if there was 20 guys in that room. But he had to go in without a SWAT team. And I heard through sources that he was a little concerned about that, because he had to go in with basically an ad hoc team of police officers that he never worked with. Not to say those guys weren't experienced and going to do whatever they had to do to get into the room, but SWAT trains together as a team for a reason. I was on a SWAT team when I was on the military police in the Army. You train with those team members because you all know how they're going to react and where everybody's going to go when you go in. So the night of the worst mass shooting in U.S. history, the SWAT team in Vegas, not even five other guys could have made it into that stairwell an hour and 5 minutes, where Levi Hancock had to use patrol officers, canine and patrol officers, go in that room. Sheriff Lombardo hasn't spoken about that, and nobody's even asked him about that. I call up and I ask to hang up the phone, Ken's active investigation. So to me, that is a major, major, major problem. Where were they? Were they somewhere else? How come they weren't into the room? Okay, now get on another subject. I want to cover all these subjects. Stephen Paddock fired out that window for 10 minutes, and he was not counted by either a counter sniper or any type of fire, at least to get him away from the window. My question would be, why was that? Because there's been enough incidences in this country where you've had snipers from elevated positions shooting down at crowds or people in the street. Okay? Now, after 9/11, the 9/11 report, which a lot of it, they made a lot of, I think a lot of it was just the nonsense, but one of the things they came out and they said, it was a failure of imagination. Well, when I wrote my story and said that incompetence led to the Las Vegas massacre, I got all this hate mail. And incompetence at a command level, because nobody could have even thought that, hey, we got 22,000 people on a corner in an open venue, across the street, we have, and behind them, we have high-rise towers of Las Vegas hotels, the Mandalay Bay across the street, you have the Luxor, you have the Tropicana, and nobody said, what if somebody decides to go up there and start shooting down? Are we ready for that? They have helicopters out here. The police helicopters have FLIR on them. You know, why couldn't they have snipers on there ready to go? And, you know, the airport was right next to that, okay? They obviously didn't that night. And that bothers me because I think lives could have been saved, at least if somebody was there to identify that window as fast as they could, the windows he was firing out of, and, no, not to hit him, but just to lay some fire down to keep him from firing out. And we know that didn't happen, and people got killed. Now, the other side of that is the casinos, okay? And I put in my story. Since 9/11, all Las Vegas casinos were put on notice, both by Homeland Security and the FBI, because I was director at two different properties, and I saw the bulletins coming in from Homeland Security, that Las Vegas has been a target since 9/11 and even before of terrorist organizations. There's magazines that are out there online. There's one that's called Inspire, one's kind what's called Palestine, when they basically tell their jihadists in this country is to go over and you know, target Las Vegas and other areas. Las Vegas has been mentioned, okay? So now since 9/11, you got what, 15 years, okay? Homeland Security, I went to a lot of these schools. Some of these things are hanging on the wall over here. Active shooter, initial law enforcement response to suicide bomb attacks. When I went to those courses with my guys, my team from Riviera, my supervisors, okay, there were management personnel and other security personnel for just about every casino in Las Vegas. So everybody knew what Homeland Security was telling you. Be aware of active shooters. Be aware of Mumbai-type attacks. They even came out and said years ago that critical infrastructure, including hotels, specifically in Las Vegas, should have their own security response team to be able to act immediately in an active shooter incident so you can at least suppress the guy's fire, the gunman's fire, until police get there. Because every second that goes by, bodies are stacking up. So Paddock was allowed to bring 23 firearms, thousands of rounds of ammunition and magazines into the Mandalay Bay. Nobody stopped. It was, you know, there was no security measures in place that could have caught that. And people say, well, yes, they don't want to do security measures because it's a hassle to the customers. Tell that to the dead people. Green luggage. They didn't want to do it. They do it at airports. They say it'll take too much time. Okay. You want to do something real simple? You have canine teams, explosive detection teams, because if an explosive detection team was rolling by that cart that had all that weapons and ammunition on it, those weapons were fired, the ammunition was touched with the explosive residue, the explosive canine team would have, more than likely, would have hit on that stuff. None of that was in place. So he was allowed to bring all that stuff into his room. And I say allowed because that's exactly what he did. He knew. He knew. He's been in casinos, he's been gambling. He knew you can bring whatever you want into a room, nobody's going to check luggage, they don't do any type of screening like they do at the airport. But what makes it even worse in this case is that his car that was parked out in valet had explosive materials in it. I think there was 50 pounds, they said, or something, of tannerite or something like that, okay? Now, what if that car just didn't have explosives in the car? It was an IED. Again, that car rolled right into valet because there was no canines patrolling that would have hit on the explosives that were in that car. That's my point. So when they come out and they say, you know, there's nothing that the casinos could have done because, you know, it's a hassle to the guest. Now, I'm going to tell you this, okay? You can rest assured that somewhere in the world or this country, there isn't one or a group of people who are studying this whole event that happened on October 1st. And they're listening and studying the radio traffic, which is still available online. You can play it back 1,000 times on the Internet. They're listening to the traffic. They're listening to how the tactics of the police that night on these, on the, especially when these calls came in on, and I'll get to that in a second. But what I'm saying is people are studying this, okay? And 15 years almost since 9/11, and the casinos haven't basically done anything because it's never going to happen. After Mumbai, India attack, more bulletins came out from Homeland Security. You need to be here, because a terrorist attack inside a casino, say, is only going to happen two ways. It's either going to be an active shooter or it's going to be a suicide bomber. So do you have any procedures in place to detect that type of, you know, explosives or weapons coming in your casino? Do you have, you know, an immediate reaction force? Not 5, 10, 15 minutes later after the police get there or longer, but your own security force. So those are the issues that should have been done way before this thing took place. And maybe lives would have been saved that night, or maybe you wouldn't have the amount of the dead bodies and the amount of injuries that we had over there in the concert venue. Now, I know I'm talking fast. I only feel like I got 15 minutes. I want to bring up something else. After Paddock stopped firing, the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department dispatcher was putting out calls for active shooters at multiple properties. This went on for 2 hours. Now, Joe Lombardo, the sheriff, was on one of the being interviewed the other day, and he said this, that to them, you know, they went out and they made it seem like it was nothing. They went on, they quelled it, we checked, there was nobody there. But these things went out for well over 2 hours after Paddock had stopped firing. Active shooter at the New York, New York. Suspect from the Mandalay Bay or something going down the escalator at Luxor. Active shooter now at the Tropicana. Shots fired at Aria. Shots fired at Bellagio. Guy going in with the assault weapon in the back door of Bellagio. These were going on every 10, 15 minutes. They were sending strike teams, which were groups three or more police officers, to all these locations to try to find out what the heck was going on. A lot of these calls were also coming from police and fire personnel themselves. Now, I don't know what they heard, but Sheriff Lombardo said, I'm assuming what people heard, to paraphrase what he said, was because they saw people with blood on, assumed there was a firefight. Well, I'm going to say this, okay? I don't know what happened to those other properties. I just heard what was listening to the radio traffic that night, is that this. They were receiving multiple calls being broadcasted from the police dispatcher to police officers to send units to this hotel and this hotel long time after. A lot of this stuff started at about 10:45 and went on for, you know, well within 2 hours from one property to another. My question is this, okay, to the police department, to Sheriff LeBard, because nobody brings these questions up to him. Has all that been investigated? Who was calling in all these calls? Now, obviously, some of them are going to be yes. There's going to be some people that maybe have heard shots. But Paddock had stopped firing. So was this one person that was calling all these calls? Was it a group of the same voices? Was this done because possibility that maybe something else was supposed to happen that night and they were trying to spread out the forces of the police? Or was it done because somebody took advantage of the situation and said, we'll start calling these things, we'll see how they react in case maybe we do it next time? It was so much of a concern, sir, that on the radio, I believe one of the SWAT commanders actually went on there and said, be careful that they're not trying to split up our forces. Okay, I wrote 35 stories on this, and I nitpicked every transmission that I heard and every time the sheriff made a statement. So, you know, that's a whole other ballgame, is why all these shot calls were coming in when nobody was firing weapons. There was even one I heard on the other day from the fire dispatch. It was about an hour and 10 minutes after Paddock stopped firing. And this is what she says over the fire radio, not the police radio, I'm talking about the fire channel. She's talking to one of the captains, one of the battalion guys, and she says, I have the spouse of one of our members up on the roof level bar of Mandalay Bay and just saying they have an active shooter up there. Okay? This is well over an hour, 15 minutes after Paddock stopped firing. And then he goes back and says, who is it? She said, a spouse of one of our members. And they said, we'll have to contact Metro. I haven't heard anything in the paper about what that was all about. And another thing that was going on that night is officers inside the venue were actually calling in that they had active shooters in the venue. Well, you could put that to say, okay, maybe they didn't know where the shots were coming from. You know, well, you know, a trained police officer would probably know whether, because they've said, looks like we have shots coming out of Mandalay Bay on the 32nd floor, but they were actually calling and saying we have active shooters inside the venue. Okay, that came out. That's the sound that they heard from across the street? Maybe, maybe not. But then another interesting transmission happens over the police radio is this. We hear one of the officers say the suspect is headed to an RV near Koval Lane in Tropicana. Okay? The suspect. What suspect? And then the next thing you hear is a female police officer say, I have my shotgun deployed at the back window of this RV. Okay? And then all of a sudden you don't hear anything. Whether they switch to an encrypted channel or something, I want to know what that incident was about. And why am I bringing it up? Because when I was reviewing the fire channel's communications, which I started to do last week, you hear the fire, one of the people come across, one of the firemen come across the radio, and they said, notify Metro, you have one of their officers limping, chasing a guy in fatigues near this RV. And so I put that together with the transmission from the police, and I haven't heard nothing from the local media out here about what that incident was about. Was it a mistake? But who were they chasing, and why did they have this RV surrounded? When they called the guy running, they said, people are telling me, he's a suspect, and he's got a black bag, and then they surrounded this RV, and all this. I know I got a couple of minutes. I want to specifically say something here. I'm going to read a direct quote. Okay? On October, for a month, Sheriff Lombardo, when I broke the story that a SWAT officer fired a weapon in the room, didn't come out and say nothing until about 24 days after I broke the story. And then he says, well, yeah, it's under investigation, but, and that's all he says. A SWAT officer fired his weapon. Okay? We haven't known of it. Who fired? What type of weapon was it? Where did the round of rounds go? We still do not know. Now, I also broke this story, and I only got 10 minutes left, and this is very important. I was told that the homicide division was pulled from the investigation of the Paddock shooting. Listen to what I just said. The homicide division of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department was pulled off the investigation of the worst mass shooting in modern American history, and it was turned over to a group called the Force Investigating Team, or FIT. Okay. FIT, the Force Investigating Team, they investigate officer-involved shootings and officer-involved use of force. Okay? So the big question here, and Sheriff Lombardo has never mentioned it, and nobody's even asked him about this, is why was Homicide Division, if true, and my information came from police sources, so I know it's true, and I'll tell you something else how I know it's true also, is that why were they pulled off the worst mass shooting investigation in modern American history? And like, who the hell is investigating the dead bodies and the suicide of Paddock? Because homicide investigators investigate suicides to make sure it's a suicide and not a homicide. So if they were indeed pulled off the case, and my information from inside sources that it was, okay, why was that? Now I'm going to tell you something else. The force investigating team does not answer to the same bureau commander that the homicide division answers to. They answer to the bureau commander of something called the public accountability thing. Well, guess who the commander is of that unit? Captain Kelly McMahill, who is the wife of the number two person running the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department, under Sheriff Kevin McMahill. Now, to me, that sounds a little bizarre, okay? And I can't get any answers. Now, I'm going to tell you how I know that's true, that statement, because last week, before Thanksgiving, here's the email. You can't see it, but that's an email. And I can't even believe that they did this. This is from the Internal Affairs Bureau of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department to me. And the detective, I'm not going to mention his name, but the detective says he wants to talk to me about some of the articles that I wrote for the Baltimore Post-Examiner. He wants to know who my sources were, okay? Specifically when I said that the force investigation team was working the case and homicide was pulled off it. That's what he wanted. I wasn't going to call him back, because I never heard of this before, where a police will call up an investigative journalist and want their sources. So I said, no, I'll call him back. His line was recorded, my line was recorded, and what do you want? He says, I was, you know, tasked with doing the investigation, long story short, and we read your story, and you said that a retired police officer told you that the homicide was pulled off. And I said, what did you want? He says, well, I want to know who your sources are to make sure they're actually retired personnel and not active duty. Well, you know, you just told me in your email it was retired, so why even call me up? He said, we're not concerned with the retired personnel, and my people have talked to me. He says, that's a bunch of nonsense. Yes, they were, because the sheriff has the power to pull people's, the retirement stuff, the badges and stuff like that, and the authorization to carry a concealed weapon. So I didn't tell him anything. And then he says, well, can you at least tell me this? You say in your story that you were told by the homicide division, the homicide division of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department told me when I called up they were not involved in the investigation. The force investigation team was. And I put that in my story. You can read it online, the Baltimore Post-Examiner. Okay? And he wants to know who in the homicide division told you that, told me that. Was it the person who answered the phone? I said, the homicide division. So that's where that conversation, it went nowhere. So just that conversation alone confirmed to me, hey, yeah, force investigating team is definitely, otherwise they would have said, well, he's lying in the story, it's no big deal, so who cares? So that's what's going on. So we have the worst mass shooting in modern American history, and homicide division was pulled off the case and given to the force investigating team. My point is this. Why were they investigating that when no officer used force or fired their weapon at Paddock? Now, somebody said, well, maybe they're investigating the discharge of the weapon. Okay, we haven't heard anything on that. It doesn't take... Yesterday was 8 weeks since the shooting, okay? We haven't heard anything on that investigation. So that's a five-minute investigation. Oh, officer, did you trip? I mean, accidental discharges happen, okay? But that does not explain why homicide was pulled off the case. What is the force investigating team investigating? Is it some simple as investigating the discharge of the weapon? But then who investigated the suicide to make sure it was a suicide and not a homicide? There may be some very simple answers to this, but from the start, Sheriff Lombardo has given false, misleading, and deceptive answers on a lot of this stuff. Now, I want to come to this. I only got a couple seconds left, Ian. I want to read this.
Doug, I've made arrangements. We're going to skip the top of the hour break. You've got you've got another 10 minutes.
Okay. On November 2nd, Sheriff Lombardo gave an interview to a KLS-TV reporter, sat down with him, okay? And that's an investigative journalist, okay? I can say anything about him, but I just want to read stuff, and I'll read it verbatim, because I don't want anybody getting calls from people saying that's not exactly what he said, okay? Now, he says this. It was hard to determine, this is Lombardo, where the shots were coming from. Once it was evaluated, it was coming from the Mandalay Bay, as you can imagine how hard it would be to pinpoint the room from the outside and blah, 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 okay? Why am I bringing that up? Because from the start of this investigation, something was wrong. It took him 2 weeks to figure out that Paddock didn't check in on the 28th, but then he checked in on the 25th, and he was in the room almost a week before he started firing. Why it took him that long to figure it out, I don't know. I said in one of my stories, maybe it was an inept investigation, but who knows, okay? Then they changed the timeline 3 weeks, three different times. The first thing Sheriff Lombardo and Undersheriff Kevin McMahill said at press conferences was that Jesus Campos, the Mandalay Bay security officer who was unarmed, was shot when he interrupted Paddock firing at the crowd, and they called him a hero. That's the first thing that went out. And then a week later, Sheriff Lombardo comes out and says, no, that's not true. He was now shot, we believe, 6 minutes before Paddock stopped firing. And then the next one that comes out the next week is, no, now we looked at some stuff, and now he was shot at about the same time or right when Paddock started firing, okay? And everybody started going crazy about different theories because that would have helped Mandalay Bay, MGM Resorts International, that owns Mandalay Bay, in a civil suit. Because if they knew 6 minutes before ahead of time, then why did it take so long for Metro to know that the shots were coming from room, from 135 on the 32nd floor? Part of this, there's just so much stuff of this. But then, you know, Sheriff Lombardo goes on that interview, and he says, let me find a paper here. Okay. He's talking to the reporter, and he says, because originally he said when he was getting criticized within the first week, when everybody across the world was saying, why did it take the SWAT team an hour and 5 minutes to breach that door? Well, we now know there was no SWAT team. It was one SWAT member with an ad hoc team of patrol officers that went into the room. So he came out and he said, well, once Paddock stopped firing, it became a barricaded suspect. Okay? And my response in my stories, that's a bunch of BS. Because they never made telephone contact with him. They never had verbal communication with him. So they didn't even know he was in the room. And how do we know that? Because the guy actually gets on the radio, the SWAT officer, and says, we have to breach this room now, an hour and 5 minutes later, because we have to pop this door, is what he said, to see if he's still in here or he went somewhere else. So they didn't even know the guy may have been in the room. So an hour and 5 minutes, they're in the hall figuring how they're going to breach the door when Paddock could have been down on the strip, you know, doing more havoc. It didn't turn out that way, but they did not know that night, and that's my point. Now, the sheriff said to this reporter on this interview that the reason why, this is what he says on November 2nd, okay? He says, we had to get into that room as fast as we could because we didn't want him reloading magazines or an opening fire on the crowd. That's an all-out BS lie because they didn't go into the room immediately. They waited in that hall for an hour and 5 minutes because the patrol officers, who I know wanted to go into that room, were told, no, stand by and wait for SWAT to make a plan. Well, SWAT never showed except one officer. Then Sheriff Lombardo goes on in the interview and he says, but you got to understand something, talking to the reporter. This just blew me away. Had he opened fire again, we would have breached the door immediately. Well, how long does it take you to breach a door? Hopefully the explosive works, a couple of seconds, 50, 20 seconds. In the meanwhile, Paddock is killing more people. So this came from the highest law enforcement officer, the head of the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. You can go online and look at that interview. It's KLS TV. You get his exact words in there. I wrote a story about it. And this is some stuff that I heard.